This is Politico Energy. Stay tuned after the show for a message from Chevron.
You know, it's important that we accelerate the transition to sustainable energy.
So what is sustainability? You've probably heard the term sustainability in some context or another.
Sustainability means that things can keep going, can sustain themselves, can continue into the future, and go on forever.
Sustainability has become a big buzzword.
From a human perspective, sustainability for our planet means that it can continue to do what it was designed to do.
Everybody's talking about it right now, but the truth of the matter is, there's really not a lot going on policy-wise at the federal level. Like, the federal government is just never really engaged on this subject in any meaningful way.
In a country where the federal government seems unable or unwilling to act on climate change policy, what does it look like to actually take action?
Corporations are definitely taking the lead here in the U.S., and local governments are starting also to lead where the federal government won't. So we thought we'd dig down into these states and cities that are acting on some of these issues and see what they were doing and what was working.
I'm Carlos Prieto, and today we're going to look across the country for places that are taking action on climate change and see what's working as they build more sustainable communities.
We found a real mix of things. There are a lot of innovative things going on. There are a lot of fresh ideas.
That's Lorraine Willard, an editor at Politico who's been working with our sustainability team. They recently put out a story titled Six Places Doing It Right.
Some of them have been around for a while. Some of them are brand new. We can't really say yet what is really going to work and what isn't, but there are a lot of promising things happening.
And one of these ideas is actually coming to fruition in Virginia, which is precisely where Lorraine lives.
Virginia is a coal state and is a little bit of an old school state, but one of the big power companies here, Dominion, has made the decision to go with renewables. And so it's actually on the forefront of a really cool idea on how to store renewable power when it's not needed. In Virginia, Dominion is teaming up with school districts to store power in school bus batteries. For example, like now, when we're having a really hot summer in Virginia, and people turn up their air conditioning, all these parked school buses with their charged up batteries can be tapped to provide power to the grid instead of firing up, say, a coal power plant.
Virginia is just one place that's moving forward with new ideas. Local governments play a central role by pushing for policies that define how companies in their states will operate and the priorities that they will follow. But states also have to back their agenda with, that's right, money.
So New Jersey just announced its plans to develop a green bank, which isn't actually a bank, but it is a pot of money, essentially, that goes to financing green projects. I'm Samantha Maldonado. I'm Politico New Jersey's energy and environment reporter. So basically, that means that through this pot of money, they'll be crowding in private capital to fund and finance infrastructure projects, energy efficiency projects, things like that. Mostly it's going to focus on projects that cut carbon, that create jobs, anything that sort of advances sustainability. So that could be community solar, expanding energy efficiency projects for especially low-income and middle-income families.
And the Garden State isn't the first one to try this idea of a green bank.
They're taking the lead from other states in the tri-state area. Connecticut was, I believe, the first, and New York's is probably the biggest with $1 billion of capital that started it off. But there's also green financing mechanisms that pop up in other places in other forms. So California, in different cities, even across the world, there's sort of different green financing mechanisms. They've been pretty effective in terms of being able to develop when traditional means of capital sort of pull back. Generally, like big bank lenders in times of recession don't really lend as much, but green banks and other places have shown that even if they sort of ramp up their financing, it will demonstrate to sort of the normal traditional quote-unquote lenders that continuing to invest in these types of projects is a good bet, and that can keep them going. One thing that a lot of my sources really emphasize to me is that it doesn't really take very much public money to start a green bank and to be able to attract private capital. So for example, New Jersey is planning to start their green bank with $12 million in revenue from the Regional Carbon Cap and Trade Program. And that's not very much compared to New York's $1 billion that it started its green bank with. But all my expert sources basically were in agreement saying, well, that's enough money to really shake things up and attract other private capital in order to, you know, really effectively advance some of these initiatives that they're looking at.
Now, if New Jersey and Virginia are examples of how to take a completely new idea to get sustainable solutions, other places can show us how to reimagine an old idea through a modern lens. Enter Sarasota, a small city along the Florida Gulf Coast where they're bringing in robots to help the city's recycling program. Cue Nancy Vu.
I am an editorial intern for the sustainability desk at Politico. So essentially they have kind of streamlined how we recycle, so they can put all the recyclables within one bin, and then when it reaches the recycling center or facility, the robots, they sort them out themselves.
The company behind this futuristic idea is AMP Robotics, and their idea was to basically put 14 huge robots in the middle of a 100,000 square foot facility, feed them recycling products with the conveyor belt, and, you know, let them do the sorting.
So from what they told me, their rates of recovery and purity rates are a lot higher than having like manual laborers pick out the material streams by hand. So they told me that their AI is 80 picks per minute. So they're able to pick out 80 materials within that minute. And recovery rates are 90 to 95%. And purity rates are 98 or 99%.
These sorting robots aren't just much more efficient than humans, they're also constantly learning on the job. And that's because all of AMP's robots are interconnected, so if one identifies a new material in, I don't know, Colorado, then all of its robot colleagues in Florida will learn to identify this material. They quickly update at once without having the lag time of humans passing the information to each other. It's like they're doing the job and attending a national conference at the same time. And Nancy says that robots could be a game changer for the recycling industry across the country, which has long suffered from high turnover rates, inefficient labor outcomes, and ever-rising costs. By now, it should be clear that sustainability encompasses all aspects of our lives, from the power we use to run our ACs during hot summers like this one, to the kind of programs that get funding from our local governments. But sustainability also defines what our cities look like in the not-so-distant future.
My name is Deborah Kahn. I cover environment and transportation policy for Politico California.
Take California as an example.
The inland areas have a lot of sprawl and a lot of traffic, and of course there's LA. LA's got more than like 15 million people in the greater LA area.
And if there's one thing that LA is famous for...
Hollywood, that's Hoobie Valley, Hoobie Hollywood.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's that. But definitely one of the things that Los Angeles is known for is the insane traffic.
LA's got some public transportation links. You know, Northern California has that too. But yeah, I mean, the car culture stereotype is very true.
And to be fair, they're not the only ones. Take Atlanta or Milwaukee, for example. These are places that have taken their highway infrastructure to monumental, almost comical levels. But there's one thing that is exclusive to California.
So basically, they want to encourage infill. So they want to encourage people to build new developments on existing footprints and to discourage people from building developments further out that will just add to the amount of cars that you need and the amount of driving that happens.
And how does the state plan to direct where development happens?
So under the California Environmental Quality Act, all development projects above a certain size have to analyze what their environmental impact is going to be. And so previously, the way that they interpreted the California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA, for development projects was to analyze how much it would contribute to new traffic. So now what they're doing is they're analyzing the expected increase in vehicle miles traveled, and you want to reduce that. So rather than seeing the impact on the environment as being an increase in congestion that needs to be fixed, they're seeing it as you want to offset the increase in vehicle miles traveled. And so that, instead of trying to incentivize the lessening of congestion by widening lanes, you would instead add bike lanes, or you would invest in transit links or passes or something like that.
California, New Jersey, Virginia, Florida, ideas to build a more sustainable future are flourishing everywhere, and they're growing in just about any direction.
Local governments and communities and businesses know what they need.
Lorraine Wellard again.
They each have their own specific pressing needs that might be different from other people's specific pressing needs. In Pittsburgh, they might be mostly worried about polluting their water with fracking chemicals, while in California, maybe the big problem is, you know, too much pollution from cars and vehicles. So it's the next step. Federal government hasn't done anything, and I don't think anyone's holding out hope that the federal government will take any dramatic kind of movement. There's just too much polarization in Washington right now, and the current administration and political leaders, this is just not at the top of their agenda. So frustration has caused the campaigns to kind of go down to the local level. But the other thing is, it's much easier to do things close to home. Whereas, you know, on a big sort of national or global level, sometimes it's hard to convince people, you know, in small communities to make changes.
But just because the federal government isn't leading on this front, that doesn't mean that states are going at this alone. In fact, if sustainable policies succeed in the U.S., it could be because states are keeping an eye on each other and replicating what works.
Ideas are definitely being shared. We do have these local labs, if you want to call cities, are kind of like local laboratories where they can try out new things. Cities and mayors, you know, they do talk to each other. So, yes, there's an exchange of ideas. And one good thing about letting localities take the lead on this stuff is if somebody makes a mistake, then there's not a lot of damage done, right? There's one city trying something on a small scale, and if it doesn't work, then other people can learn lessons from the fact that it didn't work.
Huge thanks to Lorraine Willard, Nancy Vu, Samantha Maldonado, and Deborah Kahn. You can find the reporting and even more sustainable policies in a story titled Six Places Doing It Right, and of course on our sustainability newsletter called The Long Game. To subscribe, go to politico.com/thelonggame. Subscribe to Politico Energy wherever you listen, and leave us a review on Apple Podcast. If you want more energy news in your inbox, subscribe to our newsletter at politico.com/morningenergy. Thanks, and we'll be back again tomorrow.
Chevron has spent over $1 billion building one of the largest integrated carbon capture and storage facilities, capable of capturing up to 4 million tons a year. Learn more at chevron.com/possibilities.